This is the Brooklyn Culture Jam. I'm your host, Daniel Kinch. Tonight we'll be speaking to Richard Forer. He is an author and a widely quoted expert on Middle East matters. We'll be talking about the election of Bibi Netanyahu and what that means for prospects for peace in the area.
They would be angry at the fact that they've been deceived all their lives, and they would not support what Israel is doing to the Palestinians. But as it is right now, what I'm saying is that people are afraid. The reason I made that statement is people are afraid to look into the history. And it's not just because they're afraid of what it will reveal about Israel. It's because of what it will reveal about them. Because when you support, let's put it this way, most people are decent, most people believe in justice. And so when they support something like injustice and indecency, which characterizes Israel's behavior towards the Palestinians for many, many decades, when you support that and you still believe that you're a humane person, you still believe that you're a person who believes in decency and justice, you're going to have to rationalize your support. And so what people do is they go into denial. And so they deny that they're supporting injustice and indecency, and then they rationalize their reasons. So it's not because they're supporting Israel because they believe in Israel, and because Israel is only defending itself against a people who want to throw the Jews into the sea. That's the rationalization, and that's all it is. Because anyone who studies the history, anybody who studies it with a fair mind, using mostly Israeli sources, even if they really study the history objectively, they will find that Israel has never wanted to make peace, that Israel has always deliberately targeted Palestinian civilians, and Israel has always intended to ethnically cleanse as many Palestinians as possible and take over as much of the land of historic Palestine as possible.
Now, this is an opinion you have come to through a long journey, and I want you to let my audience know some of that journey, because I started reading your book recently, and you were a member of AIPAC, which I mentioned. What turned you around on this sense of Israel's, if you will, what Israel stands for today versus what people think it stands for? Or is that a mischaracterization? Is that a mischaracterization on my part?
No, not really. People have an idealistic image of Israel. I had a very idealistic image of Israel. To me, prior to my transformation, I believed that Israel was basically a benign country that treated the Palestinians very well, that never targeted civilians, and even in conflict, even in so-called wars, invasions, whatever you want to call them, that Israeli soldiers bent over backwards not to kill innocent civilians, even at the risk of their own lives. That's what I actually believed. And I believed that the only reason there wasn't peace was because the Palestinians refused to make peace, because the Palestinians wanted to take back all of the land, all of Palestine. They wanted it all, and they didn't want any Jews there. But what happened was, in 2006, as you may remember, in July of 2006, Hezbollah, the Lebanese paramilitary organization, conducted a cross-border raid into northern Israel, and they killed 3 Israeli soldiers and abducted 2. And, when they did that, by the way, they did that 3 weeks after Hamas had captured Gilad Shalit, Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit, from the Gaza-Israel border. I saw the action of Hezbollah in combination with the 3 week earlier action of Hamas as proof that my belief that the Arab world would not rest until Israel was wiped from the face of the earth, that was proof, that proved that I was correct. And I saw it as I was so upset, because I saw myself in the place of Gilad Shalit, and I saw myself in the place of the Israeli soldiers who were abducted and killed, being Jewish, being so strongly identified as Jewish. And to me, it seemed that the entire Arab world, as symbolized by Hezbollah and Hamas, was so pathologically hateful towards Jews that they were more than willing to sacrifice thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of their own billion-plus people in order to wipe Israel from the face of the earth. And so when Israel invaded Lebanon the day after the Hezbollah's abduction and murder of the Israeli soldiers, I was all for it. And as you may remember, Israel was accused of using disproportionate force in their invasion of Lebanon. Over a million Lebanese civilians were displaced, and I think something like 1,400 Lebanese were killed, many of them citizens. And of course, Israel used the usual claim that that the Hezbollah had embedded its soldiers within civilian populations and was firing rockets from civilian populations. That was later debunked by human rights groups that were there at the time. Anyway, I was, as I said, I was so upset, so I started complaining to my friends about the Arab world and how the Arab world wanted to destroy Israel. And I, in particular, I spoke to two of my closest friends, both very wise men, both very compassionate, both of whom I knew had always been critical of Israel. And although they didn't normally speak about it that much, but when the subject would come up, they would criticize Israel. And neither of these men were Jewish, by the way. And but this time I thought, well, given the circumstances, given that Hezbollah started this with its you know, with its raid into northern Israel at 3 weeks after Hamas's capture of Shalit, these guys will finally see the light. So I started complaining to them individually, and in to my utter surprise, shock, I should say, neither one agreed with me. They both accused Israel of using disproportionate force and of unnecessarily invading Lebanon and of also being the main culprit in the hostilities over many decades. So this only reinforced my identification with my fellow Jews.
So what turns this around then?
Well, what turns this around is that just by chance, a Jewish friend happened to call me from 2,000 miles away to tell me he was going to be visiting me in New Mexico. And after he told me that, I agreed that was a good idea, and then I started complaining about the Arab world. And I went on a two-hour diatribe complaining and complaining about how bloodthirsty they were. And at a certain point, now I knew this friend had, who was Jewish, I knew that he had studied the subjects to a pretty serious degree over the years, but he was very neutral and very non-judgmental, and he just allowed me to really vent for 2 hours.
Yeah.
He rarely said anything, and when he did say something, it was nothing critical of me. It was just a statement of fact, like, no, that's not true. What Israel is really wants to have is the Litani River, which separates Israel from Lebanon. Anyway, at the end of the conversation, he said, look, why don't you read books by these two Israeli authors. They're scholars and professors. You might enjoy reading them, and you'll learn a lot, and they're well-respected. And the two were Baruch Kimmeling and Tanya Reinhardt. So I ended up, and because he had not argued with me, and because he had basically opened a space for me to reconsider, or at least see that there was something maybe I was missing. And what I was missing was, when he said that to me, I realized, well, I've never even really studied the subject. I've never really read a book on the subject. And so after we hung up, I got a couple books from my local library of Jewish authors only. One was Baruch Kimmeling. I couldn't find one by Tanya Reinhardt. And I began reading. And then I had, in the midst of reading about all of these terrible things that Israel had been doing to the Palestinians, such as collective punishment, demolition of homes, even in the case of just a few rocks being thrown by a cousin, Israel would demolish maybe 12 homes for every incident that they deemed violent. The use of lethal force against children, even when there was absolutely no threat from the other side. Israel's use of torture against almost all Palestinian men who they imprisoned, false imprisonment, no charges, all of this. And I went through a series of emotions while I'm reading this. And all of this was documented by mainstream human rights organizations and the Israeli government itself. And at a certain point, I had what I would call a spiritual awakening, in which I suddenly had all of these emotions suddenly dissolved or disappeared, and my attachment to a core identity, to a core Jewish identity, could no longer be found. And when it could no longer be found, because I tried to reanimate this seemingly lost Jewish identity, what happened was I realized that I was as much Muslim or Christian as Jew, as much Palestinian as Israeli or American. And then I realized, now I could see what was going on. I could see with clarity what was going on, because prior to this awakening, I had been looking through the lens of fear, fear as a Jew, and I would see things through that lens, which would color everything, so I would always interpret things in a way that would protect my Jewish identity, which included an attachment to Israel as the safe haven, as the necessary and only safe haven of the Jewish people. I could go on and on. But
no, I wanted to stop you because we do want to get to the election and some issues about that. But one of the things
right.
that twigged as you were talking, I was thinking about so much of Israel's political support in the United States comes from people who are actually part of the evangelical Christian right. And I wondered
right.
if you had something to say about that, because you pointed out that you had deliberately sought out Jewish authors in this case to talk about.
Right. Well, the reason I sought out Jewish authors, of course, was because I knew that I wouldn't trust anything critical of Israel that was written by someone who wasn't Jewish. So that was my reason. I was so paranoid about anti-Semitism and about people's motives who aren't Jewish, that I had to only read Jewish authors. As far as Christian evangelicals, yeah, that's a problem. I think, though, that Christian evangelicals are not as critical to this ongoing problem as the American Jewish community. I consider the American Jewish community the key to resolving this problem, the Israel-Palestine problem, because I think the Christian Zionists, to a very large extent, take their cue from the Jewish community. I know that there are dispensationalists and others who believe in the second coming of Christ, and that in order for the second coming of Christ to take place, the West Bank, Judea, and Samaria have to be totally populated by Jews. But actually, I think I don't think that group is all that large, but they do give a lot of money. John Hagee, I'm thinking of in particular, gives millions of dollars every year to the Israeli settlement enterprise. But again, I think they would take their cue from the American Jewish community, and if the American Jewish community saw the light, I don't think that the power of the Zionist lobby would be all that, of the Zionist Christian community would be all that great. I could be wrong about that, but I don't think so.
But now you're taking... One of the things that I was doing in researching this is I was looking at the slagging you were taking at places like Huffington Post over the issue of you call it self-hating Jew, and that seems to be, or anti-Semitic Jew, and that seems to be something that we see pulled out, for example, on Norman Finkelstein or Noam
right.
Chomsky. And that must make you a very lonely man, I would think.
Well, I mean, it's such a common excuse, it's become a cliche, but what's happening is not just major figures like Finkelstein or Chomsky. Pretty much, Netanyahu, early in Obama's first term, Netanyahu called Rahm Emanuel and David Axelrod self-hating Jews. I mean, this is how ridiculous this is. It's a cop-out. When people, most people who are involved in fighting for equal rights for Palestinians are not anti-Semitic, and they're not self-hating Jews for those who are Jews. There is anti-Semitism for sure, but it's a small minority within that group, and that group, the group of major organizations that fight for Palestinian rights, criticizes anti-Semitism. But what's happening is when people hear someone like me or Finkelstein or a non-Jew criticizing Israel, the reason they resort to the anti-Semitism card, it's a cop-out. It's a way of avoiding the issue within themselves. I mean, after all, if I'm making a criticism of Israel, the person should at least have the integrity, who's going to disagree with me, they should at least have the integrity to find out, to either confirm or refute what I'm saying. Do
right.
some research and find out if what I'm saying is true. If I say that David Ben-Gurion admitted that Israel had stolen the land from the Palestinians, find out if Ben-Gurion said that. If I say that Ben-Gurion, General Yigal Alon, Israel's Ze'ev Schiff, Israel's greatest military analyst, and a number of Israeli chiefs of staff have all admitted that Israel has always deliberately, purposely, and consciously targeted civilians, find out if that's true or not, or if I'm making it up. But when someone reflexively accuses me or someone else of being an anti-Semite because we stand for human rights for all people instead of some people, what does that say about Judaism? In a way, they're the ones who are slandering Judaism, because if they're saying that believing in human rights for all people is anti-Jewish, and that therefore Jews should be given more leeway than other groups, and that Jews are entitled to oppress some other people, but other people are not entitled to oppress Jews, that is an anti-Semitic attitude, in my opinion, and it certainly incites anti-Semitism,
okay,
as Netanyahu incites anti-Semitism throughout the world. Just one last thing.
Well,
because what's happening is the people who incite anti-Semitism are the ones who accuse people like me of being anti-Semitic, and when they incite anti-Semitism, they then cry that the world is anti-Semitic. It's a never-ending cycle.
Which is the perfect segue to talking about the election of Netanyahu, which in the United States did not seem a sure thing prior to the election. I did some reading on this, and of course, Israel's Knesset is set up as a parliamentary system, and actually Likud only claims about 24% of the vote. How does public opinion break down on Likud and what's happening, especially with Netanyahu building more settlements, for instance, which he seems to be bound to do?
Well, remember, Likud may have only gotten about 24%, but there's a number of other parties, political parties, that are allegedly to the right of Likud. Now, I don't think they're that far to the right. I think Netanyahu actually is as far to the right as anyone in Israeli society, but because he's a very skilled politician, he doesn't let on. Although, in a way, he did let on when he admitted, finally, what he's always believed, which is that there should be no Palestinian state. He said that, and then, of course, used the race card the last day or two when he started saying, you got to come out and vote because the Arabs are voting in droves. I mean, that was really blatant racism. But
talk to me.
Sorry, go ahead, Dan.
That's okay. Talk to me a little bit, because in looking over the election, I also noticed that there was a coalition party between Labor and Hatnua, I believe, that picked up 18%.
Yeah.
And it seems to me that the minor parties in Israel really control what happens in the election, insofar as the prizes have to be handed out by, let's say, Likud to the minor parties that you say are, or you're saying may or may not be to the right of Likud, want a piece of the action, if you will, you know, ministries and so forth.
Right, because they have leverage, because in order to put together a ruling coalition, you have to bring in other parties, and then in order to bring in the other parties, you have to make certain agreements with them. Okay, I'll do this for you, I'll do that for you. That's why the religious parties have always been able to keep the religious Jews, the Hasidic and Orthodox Jews, from having to join the army. That's always been a deal they made. They actually made that deal with Ben-Gurion originally, and it still stands. But the Zionist camp, which was chaired by Isaac Herzog and Tzipi Livni, but Herzog, had the Zionist camp been able to get more votes, Herzog would have been the new prime minister. That's the old Labor Party. At least Herzog represents the old Labor Party. Tzipi Livni represents Kadima, but the old Kadima Party. But even Herzog, he was campaigning not on the basis of the change in real policy towards the Palestinians. His campaign was more on social issues, and the fact that poverty is increasing in Israel, and the economy has been pretty bad for a significant segment of the Israeli population. But Herzog even said during the campaign that he would only make a peace with the Palestinians if they had a demilitarized state. He would keep the settlement blocks in the West Bank under Israeli sovereignty. He would strengthen Jerusalem and its status as the eternal capital of the state of Israel. And, so basically he was not willing to really move from the current Israeli position on alleged two-state solution anyway. He was not in favor of a Palestinian a right of return for Palestinians within the state of Israel. So his position was one that could never be acceptable to Palestinians, and certainly would be continued violation of international law.
So what's the next step? You had already mentioned that you felt that Bibi Netanyahu perhaps may have, I can't say been responsible. People are responsible for anti-Semitic acts, but there are people in the world who are not as positive on Israel as they were even 6 months ago. Where does this change?
They're starting to see the light. Even my mother's 94-year-old friends who've been members of Hadassah all their lives and other Jewish organizations are starting to see the light, and they've been seeing the light for the last couple of years because Netanyahu is so blatant and arrogant in his attitude. But, you know, I just don't I don't see much light. The advantage, you could call it an advantage, the advantage of Netanyahu being reelected shows the true colors of Israel. Remember, 90 to 95% of the Israeli public supported this past summer's invasion of Gaza, where 2,200 people were killed, 75% of them civilians. And they are so indoctrinated, and they have been so, especially in the last 6 or 7 years since Netanyahu has been prime minister again, they've been so indoctrinated into hating the Arabs and into fearing the Arabs and into security being the only issue. The public is really deluded. They know very little about the actual history and about what Israel is really doing. And so I think, though, that Netanyahu's actions and his attitude, because it's bringing this to the fore, because it's making more and more people aware of just how brutal he and his government are willing to be towards the Palestinians and how obstructive against peace they are, that the United States, as you know, as we know, is considering other options now. Obama has said that he can't just dismiss what Netanyahu said during the campaign when he avowed that there would never be a Palestinian state. So now, of course, there's a possibility that the United States or another country may bring a resolution to the United Nations that the U.S. would not veto, stipulating a two-state solution, a fair two-state solution. Who knows? We'll have to see. Israel always seems to get its fingers in there and obstruct everything. I want to tell your listeners, though, Dan, because I know we don't have much time, that if you really read the history, you will know that Israel has always obstructed peace. They have only used peace negotiations as a way to take more settlements. And even in 2000, when Ehud Barak was at Camp David, and that was allegedly he made allegedly a generous offer to the Palestinians that Yasser Arafat rejected. That's not true. And, you know, and people need to read the history. It's in my book. It's in a lot of books. But Israel did, as Shlomo Ben-Ami, Israel's chief negotiator at Camp David on behalf of Barak, said that the conditions that Israel presented the Palestinians did not even meet modest. They didn't even make concessions enough for even the most modest of Palestinian expectations.
Yes. So, now, I promised you I would let you
understand this.
No, I understand. I promised you I would let you leave. I wanted you to do one more thing for me. And you talk about what are the potential ways out of this in your book, and also you have in your public speaking. Where do you see a solution?
Well, I see, first of all, the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement is a moral, legal movement that is nonviolent, and it's the best chance of isolating. I mean, Israel's isolating itself, but the BDS movement is a good chance, just like in South Africa a couple of decades ago, is a good chance to sending a signal to Israel if the United States would join in and other countries would join in, that Israel cannot continue the way it's going. I mean, how long can Israel occupy millions of people, millions of non-Jewish people? How long can this go on? It's such a linchpin. It's not. It may not be the linchpin, but it is a significant linchpin on all of the confusion and all of the suffering and all of the violence in the Middle East. So what I'm hoping, and I'm not real positive about this, but I'm hoping that at some point the United States has to speak out and insist that Israel end its occupation. And the way to do that is to stop vetoing resolutions in the United Nations and actively make clear to Israel that it will get no more aid, military or other aid, from the United States until it starts until it ends the occupation. And it's probably going to have to be a two-state solution, because it, certainly Israel would never accept a single state where the West Bank and Gaza are included, even without Gaza, because it would lose, it would no longer be a majority, very quickly it would never be, it would no longer be a majority Jewish state, you know, majority population of Jews.
Right. That was something actually I remember reading Nat Hentoff writing about 20 years ago, that it had to be a two-state solution because eventually the demographics would work against Israel.
But yes. Now I personally would rather see a single state, because I don't see why people can't get along just because they happen to have different religions. And in fact, I think there's a very significant percentage of Palestinians who could easily get along with their Jewish neighbors. I think the indoctrination, contrary to what a lot of people who support Israel believe, the indoctrination is much heavier in Israel than it is among the Palestinians. In fact, the Harry Truman Institute out of Tel Aviv, the United States State Department, they have done studies, and they say that there's surprisingly little propaganda and hate towards Jews in Palestinian textbooks. But, of course, Palestinians don't need textbooks to tell them what's going on, because when a soldier knocks on their door at midnight and breaks in and starts damaging their furniture and arrests kids and people without charge, you know, they see this all the time. They see their parents, their father's getting killed, their brother's getting killed, people being thrown in prison. It's a daily occurrence for Palestinians. Israel stealing their resources, not allowing them to have electricity or water. You know, so Israel has to start treating people humanely and end the occupation. That's the main thing. And whether it's a two-state or one-state solution, I don't know. Again, a one-state solution would be tough because there's an awful lot of hatred, and it has been incited by the right wing of Israel in particular.
Richard, I thank you so much for your time. Give us the name of your website, give us the title of your book, and let people find out more about you.
The website is richardforer.com, Forer spelled F as in Frank, O-R-E-R. My book is available at Amazon. Just type in Richard Forer. Its title is Breakthrough, Transforming Fear into Compassion, A New Perspective on the Israel-Palestine Conflict.
I thank you so much for your time. We'll be talking again, sir. I hope it's in
thank
better
you very
times.
Much, Dan. Nice to be with you.
Take care.
Okay.
Bye.
You too. Bye.
You are listening to the Brooklyn Culture Jam. I'm going to take a very short break. My friend Phil Rosenberg's Sex and Politics will not be heard tonight. I want you to listen to some information here that might be of interest to you. And in the meantime, we're going to listen to Tom Waits and Hell Broke Loose. That crazy, funny Tom Waits giving me the F word on FCC-controlled television radio. This is Dan Kinch. Welcome back to Brooklyn Culture Jam. I wanted to share something that's on my website right now, has gotten zero in the way of notice, at least in the United States. Those of you who've been listening to me for a while know that we have been covering the issues at Fukushima nuclear power plant and the meltdown. Last Thursday, TEPCO, Tokyo Electric Power Company, announced that thanks to new technology called cosmic ray muon technology, they are finally able to look into the reactor buildings at Fukushima 1 and 2. That's the good news part. The bad news part is they can find no fuel. If they can find no fuel, there are two places it went. It either went into the sky or it went underneath the reactors themselves. Now, you can read my article on BrooklynCultureJammers.com where I cite a number of nuclear experts, but the news is not what I'd call good. And in future weeks, I'm going to hope that we can talk to somebody with a little more knowledge and expertise. And by the way, if you're one of those people, you can contact me through my website, brooklynculturejammers.com. In the meantime, I've been putting up old shows. If you've been to the site, you can hear my interview with Atiq Zabinski and Kelly Stewart regarding the death of Kimani Gray, or you can also hear my interview last week with Pauline Schneider regarding near-term human extinction. Folks, I thank you all for listening. This has been, as usual, a lot of fun. I want to reach out to Phil. Thank you for letting me do this. It's a great thing, great way for me to spend Thursday nights. And have a good week.